To order. I'm joined today by Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Stedman, and myself, Senator Green. And we have some other members who will be coming in a little while when their transportation gets them here. And we have two bills on the agenda today. One is Senate Bill 206, Detention of Material Witness by Senator Bundy, and then the other is Senate Bill 289, having to do with insurance. It's the governor's bill, I believe. And we'll go ahead and begin now with Senate Bill 206. Senator Bundy, are you presenting or is your staff?
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. And appreciate an opportunity to present this bill. As you're probably aware, the genesis of this bill were some instances in Anchorage, and I'm fearful that this will migrate to other parts of Alaska, plus people from all over Alaska who come to Anchorage could be involved in this problem. And what happened is a number of us were amazed when police officers tried to detain some people at the scene of a gang shooting, and we discovered there is no material witness bill in Alaska. They were not able to retain these people. The folks involved in this basically told the cops to take a hike, jumped in the cab and left, and there was nothing the police officers could do. This is an attempt to give the police a tool in this kind of situation where they could gather important information, perhaps defuse the immediate tension that was often the case that occurs in these in instances like this, and at the same time not step on the rights of the average citizen and abuse any constitutional rights we have. Often as we try to give the police more tools and rein in the bad guys, we have to be cautious that we don't have a negative impact on the innocent. As you mentioned earlier, this bill has gone through a number of iterations, and I think we are now to the point where we have achieved that balance. And I want to publicly thank Department of Law, Mr. Guarnelli in particular, for the time, the energy that he's put in, the stress I've created for him. That's an inside joke. revenge was painful, Mr. Guarnelli. And and in any case, I think now we have those tools without impinging unnecessarily, unfairly on the general public. What happens in this bill is it increases the penalties for contempt of court for failure to honor a subpoena or refusal to answer as a witness in connection to felony crimes or an appearance before the grand jury. It allows a peace officer to temporarily detain a person under the circumstances that give the officer suspicion that the person may have witnessed a crime or was in the vicinity of a crime, such as a homicide or manslaughter, that the person may have information of material aid in an investigation of that crime, the temporary detention, and that the temporary detention is reasonably necessary to obtain or verify the identification of the persons involved, to obtain an account of the crime, to protect the crime victims from imminent harm or other important circumstances. It allows a police officer to detain a person under these circumstances, to photograph the person, to serve a subpoena, if necessary, to take the person's fingerprints if the person detained in connection with the investigation of a murder, attempted murder, misconduct involving weapons in the first degree, all of our more serious crimes. In an order to protect the innocent, it prohibits a peace officer from requiring a person to sign a subpoena issued under this section, and requires peace officers to advise a person that failure to honor a subpoena is punishable by a criminal contempt of court. It allows a person receiving a subpoena to request the district attorney to withdraw the subpoena if the person provides valid government-issued photographic ID prior to a grand jury proceeding, and it makes it a Class B misdemeanor to refuse or resist the taking of photographs or fingerprints under this section. As I said, I think this balances the needs of individual freedom with the ability to prosecute crime and to provide defendants with witnesses on their behalf. I'd like to, as Mr. Guarnelli has provided so much time and energy, would like to call upon him then for questions, if I might.
Are there questions? Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm just kind of curious the impact of this bill, you know, may have when we get involved in the domestic violence issue with children involved, and what kind of thoughts or impacts that may bring.
Yeah. And if I just a reminder again that this is for the most serious crimes, murder, manslaughter, misconduct involving weapons. But before I exceed my depth of my legal training, let me also call in Mr. Guarnelli.
Welcome, Mr. Guarnelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Could you introduce yourself and who you represent?
For the record, Dean Guarnelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And as Senator Bundy indicated, this bill is designed to clarify what I think is, for most police officers, a fairly unclear area of the law and what, in terms of what they can do with people who are at the scene of a crime who may have information that will assist the police in investigating a crime. And as he indicated, certainly in Anchorage, a number of people who may have material information to very serious crimes just tend to drift into the background and make it very difficult for the police to get the information they need. There have been a couple of cases over the last several years by the Alaska appellate courts that mention a particular uniform law. It's called the Model Code of Pre-Arraignment Procedure by the American Law Institute, and that is really where this first provision of under the temporary detention provision subsection A comes from. In other words, it is from this this model act that has been cited by our by the Alaska Supreme Court and by the Court of Appeals that says that the police can temporarily stop a person who they believe may have witnessed a crime, may have information that's of material aid to the police, and that the reason they're being stopped is to find out who they are, to find out what they know, to perhaps protect someone from further harm, or for some other, what the courts say, exigent circumstances. In other words, there's some important reason for stopping that person. And this is something that our courts have recognized, and perhaps it is part of our common law, but the limitations, the restrictions, the full authority of the police is not clear at all. And so I think that this bill is an important step in not only telling the police what they can do, but also what they can't do. Mm-hmm. With that as a background, I'll certainly take any questions.
Senator Bundy.
And if I might, and just referring back to Senator Stedman's question, in domestic violence, if it was a crime that involved a weapon, this bill would come into play. If it were domestic violence without weapons involved, then this does not come into play. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, there are actually in subsection B, there are three separate provisions, B1, 2, and 3. The primary provision, subsection A, says that in order to stop a person, to be able to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, who are you, what did you see, that would apply in any crime involving a person, any crime against a person, which would be misdemeanor domestic violence. Or a felony level property crime. And what the police can do, going down to subsection B1, what the police could do if they so choose is they could take a photograph of the person. And if the person doesn't provide any identification, they could serve them with a grand jury subpoena. It is only in those circumstances where they are investigating a murder, attempted murder, or one of these, essentially a drive-by shooting, that they could go further and actually fingerprint the person. Actually, the Alaska Court of Appeals applied this law, the model act that I mentioned, in a case involving a suspected domestic violence. And that was a case where police had gotten a report of a domestic violence. They arrived on the scene. They saw a woman and a man running to a car, got in a car, driving off. And that was a case of misdemeanor domestic violence. The police followed the car, stopped it because they thought that the woman they had seen may have been the victim of the domestic violence. And in order to see if she had been harmed or to protect her from harm, they stopped the car. And the Court of Appeals said that was proper. You know, that was an exigent circumstance in a misdemeanor case involving a crime against a person. And that is reflected in this bill. So in a misdemeanor crime involving domestic violence, if there's some reason to stop a person, they can do that. They can take their photo. If they don't have ID, they can give them a grand jury subpoena, but they cannot take their fingerprints. So that's the answer to that question.
Does that answer your question, Senator Chapman?
Or were you talking about the children who may be in the home?
Yeah, I guess the concern if you have a domestic violence issue at home and there is a weapon involved or some other, you know, felony issue involved, what's the impact with a spouse that is left and the potential impact of the kids? In other words, a lot of the spouses on occasions may want to go somewhere to avoid the confrontation, because quite frankly, I think some of our restraining orders don't work very well. I got a couple of dead women in my district that can prove that over the last 3 years. And if, you know, a woman doesn't want to be in that particular situation, she wants to go somewhere so she's better protected than a piece of paper, is she going to be detained? And then if she is, then what's going to happen to the kids? I mean, it's kind of a blunt way of putting it, Madam Chairman, but all I have to do is look at the newspapers the last 3 years to get a little agitated on the issue.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I agree that sometimes the domestic violence restraining orders are not very effective. This bill is not intended to prevent a domestic violence victim from seeking safety. All this bill does is it allows the police to find out who is in the vicinity to say, hey, wait a minute, stop, who are you, what have you seen? In most domestic violence cases, it's the victim who makes the initial call, or a friend of the victim who makes an initial call to the police to get them there in the first instance. And this is really designed to allow the police to get information to identify people who would otherwise not want to cooperate with the police, who would want to hide their identity from the police. Oftentimes, it's friends, relatives, or confederates of gang members. And this bill, to the extent that it allows the taking of fingerprints, it's really in those type of gang-related incidents that it's most useful. But in a typical domestic violence situation where the police have been called to the scene, they would get information from the woman, find out a little bit about the incident, maybe take photographs of injuries, and then allow her to go to a safe location. I mean, if they haven't already arrested the perpetrator, if the perpetrator's left the scene, allow her to go to a safe house or some other place as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Bundy?
Well, I just wanted to emphasize that this was a very temporary detention, just merely long enough to gather identification and maybe a statement. And then, of course, there's nothing's going to require a victim in that case to be with the perpetrator.
And there is language needed, I understand it, for the around the issue of the fingerprint based on some decisions in other courts.
Madam Chair, as a result of conversations on Friday afternoon with your staff and Senator Bundy's staff, there was a discussion about a further limitation on the taking of fingerprints that would be appropriate and make this less subject to any possible court challenge. And the idea being that if someone is simply a witness to a crime, and the police need their fingerprints simply to identify who is that person, to confirm their identity in these serious cases, that there should be a limitation on what the police can do with those fingerprints. In other words, they should not use those fingerprints for some sort of independent criminal investigation. And to further make that clear, there was a discussion about once the identification has been made, that those fingerprints that were taken at the scene should then be destroyed. So I actually, since Friday afternoon, I inquired of Department of Public Safety, and it is feasible to do what I just described. There are two databases of fingerprints that the Department of Public Safety keeps. One is a database of known fingerprints, people who have been convicted of crimes, people who have submitted applications for employment. My fingerprints are on file because I'm a member of the Bar Association. That was required as part of the application process. So they have these known fingerprints, and that's in one database. Then they have a separate database of unknown fingerprints from crime scenes. And it is, and you run any fingerprints that have been taken, you run them against those two databases separately. So it is possible to only run the fingerprints against the database of known fingerprint cards on file, and not for purposes of a separate criminal investigation. That's certainly possible. And if there's a match with a known fingerprint, then destroying the new ones you've taken is not a big deal. If there's not a match, you don't know who that person is, then they can be destroyed as well. But it certainly is possible to do what I've described, and it's just a matter of us not having had enough of an opportunity to craft additional language to accomplish that.
Okay, so we'll look forward to that. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is regarding the fingerprints as well on material witnesses. How is a material witness identified? And then how many other states require any witness to be fingerprinted?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the witness would be identified simply by the police at the scene of the crime. Their police are called to the scene of a crime. They see people in the area. They say, they believe that these people may have some information, and so they contact them, briefly to find out if they've seen anything. So ultimately, it is the officer at the scene who has reason to believe that a person may have information that may be of assistance. This bill has been crafted, fairly quickly over the last couple of weeks, and so I'm not in a position to tell you how many other people, how many other states have similar laws. It is certainly a trend that more and more states are trying to enact laws which will give police the authority to gather information at the scene of crimes necessary to solve those crimes. So, but I can't tell you at this point.
At what point will we know before it hits the floor, or we don't know that schedule, but how soon do you think you'll be able to find out how many other states have this additional police state power?
Through the chair, that's something that I haven't looked at yet. It would take probably a few days to do any kind of exhaustive search of other states.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir. Any other questions?
I'd just like to make a brief comment, Madam Chairman.
Senator Simmons.
The state's pretty vast, and the issues that are faced in Anchorage and Matsu and Fairbanks are certainly different issues in a lot of regards to what we face in Southeast, and we don't have gang problems down here. We have a little other issues that this bill may impact, which was the reason for the previous question, but I certainly support the concept of allowing the police to detain people so they can get a list of who they are and where they live and how to contact them. So I don't object to this bill, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And regarding Senator Hoffman's question, we currently do have a request in with NCSL and Leds Research about, and I have just very cursory knowledge that there are other states do have a material witness bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Madam Chair, let me just make one quick comment, and that is that this whole provision is really revolves around the obligation of citizens to provide testimony in court. And what I believe is one of the primary provisions in here is allowing the police to issue a subpoena on a person who has not been able to provide valid identification. I think that unless someone by testifying would incriminate themselves, they really have an obligation to society to provide testimony in court. And the way the state does that is by convening a grand jury and subpoenaing those people to testify. So really everything, taking the photographs, taking the fingerprints, it's all revolved around enforcing the subpoena and not allowing people, particularly friends and confederates of these gang members, to simply drift into the woodwork. So it really all revolves around the citizen's obligation to provide that information.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
But, I think that everyone is well aware, you could take different individuals have different ability to recall certain things, and you could go in and have somebody come in and three or four different people and say, what was that guy wearing? And all three of them would say something different. So it's, when does that, the state or the police officer have to believe the individual saying, I don't remember, I can't recall that, and the pressures that this bill puts on, maybe all of it is, arbitrary according to the police officer, and that, I guess, gives me some concern.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think there is a balance to be struck. If somebody is just walking their dog by a scene and they really haven't observed anything, I would think that the police would be able to determine that very quickly. If somebody else was right near the scene and they're off running down the street when the police contact them, I think the police have to I think we would expect the police to question that person further. There are many, many cases when the reason the person is fleeing is because he heard shots being fired and he wants to get the heck out of there. I mean, that's pretty common. And the police, I would expect the police would be able to determine, is that the reason the person's running, or is the person running because they don't want us to find out who they are and find out that they may have been involved or that they may be a member of this gang as well. So I think that we're going to have to rely to some extent on the ability of the police to sort those things out. As Chief Monaghan testified in Senate Judiciary, the police don't, you get more, what's the phrase about honey and vinegar?
Catch more flies with honey than you do.
I didn't want to equate witnesses with flies, but you certainly get more cooperation from the citizenry by being respectful to them and being nice to them, and I think that's the police the police also realize, and I know this is one thing we, you know, we tell our prosecutors. I mean, the person on the street who you encounter, you may run into the next day on your jury panel, and so I think the police really have an incentive to be respectful to people who are legitimately just minding their own business, and I think we just have to rely on the police to do that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and just point out that when this person who may or may not have witnessed something is asked to identify themselves, if they identify themselves to the police officer so the police officer can come back and ask them questions later, this bill has no impact on them. It's just the people who choose not to identify themselves. And, you know, as long as we're using old adages, the only thing necessary for evil to succeed is good people do nothing at all. And it may well be that somebody had observed something that they didn't realize was a crime, or it's just a small part of the puzzle and they don't know what they're adding to the bigger picture. And so if they simply are available for the police to ask them questions, either then or later, by providing identification, they would not be impacted by this. And they would, of course, then be good citizens.
For information, Deputy Chief Holloway is on the line to answer questions. So if anyone has questions for Chief Holloway. Is there anyone in the room who wished to testify? Okay. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Senator. It's a pleasure to be back.
With a new,
remember, he could be under
name.
Oath.
If you can let us know your name and who you represent, please.
I would, for the record, my name is John Sear. I'm the business manager for PSEA, Public Safety Employees Association. We represent state troopers, court service officers, and municipal police from Fairbanks to Unalaska to Ketchikan. So a rather wide net. And we are in favor of this bill. And we would like to thank Senator Bundy and the members of this committee, the senator for his work and the members for considering it. I think Mr. Guinelli hit it on the head. This is about the identification of people at a crime scene. And it is all too common today to have folks just say, I'm not telling you who I am, and I'm leaving. And that pretty much ends that whole scenario. It makes it pretty tough for our members to do their job to keep this state in the way we all want it to be to live in. There is a balance here that is struck. The issue is one of clarity for police officers so that it lays out what can and cannot happen. I won't take this committee's time and go through it. It's, I think, relatively obvious on the surface. I just wanted to say that we absolutely do support this bill. We think it is necessary, and we think it's time for this state to, if you will, get ahead of the power curve. I think we are just beginning to see the problems in this state around gang-related activity, around meth labs, around organized crime. The more money that flows, the more crime that happens, and the more people have, the bad people wish to remain unknown. And that's a serious problem for all of us.
Are there any questions for Mr. Sear? Thank you very much.
Thank
I saw you.
You
sitting there, and I said, I know those guys probably have a testimony.
We,
so.
We do.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah. Are there any further questions? Well, we'll wait for that amended language to come forward and then try to bring this back up tomorrow.
Thank you. And just one comment that I wanted to mention, that while this the incident that generated thoughts that brought this bill forward occurred in Anchorage. I did want to point out, as Mr. Sears said, that the troopers with a statewide responsibility could see application of this bill as well.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll set 206 aside and wait for the language to make the amendment regarding fingerprints and move on to 289, and I misspoke when I said it was a governor's bill. It's a committee bill by request. Well, Senator Bundy, I'm trying to figure out who's in your office.
I look around and I see all your staff in here. You're too busy. Okay, are you presenting 289?
I actually just introduced the bill, and then because it was by request from the Division of Insurance, refer to Linda Hall.
Okay, thank you.
So we have 289. I understand that it is technical, very technical in nature, and with that, I will turn to the technical person, Ms. Hall.
Now that was a brief introduction. Yeah. Morning, Linda. How are you?
Good morning.
Without crutches.
Without crutches.
Good
without
for you.
This morning. So I am much better. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Linda Hall. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance, here today to do comments on SB 289. There was a CS from Labor and Commerce, and as Senator Bundy indicated, it is unfortunately a fairly technical bill, and it's 38 pages long. I would like to make some general comments, and I've tried to group them, the pieces that deal with life, health, and annuity products, and the pieces that deal with the other entities we regulate. SB 289 contains numerous changes to Title 21 that are designed to provide protection to consumers who purchase life, annuity, and health insurance, to ensure that state statutes are consistent with federal law and National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Acts and Standards, to update division procedures and transactions, and to make Alaska licensing more consistent with national standards. To get into the life and health areas, sections 3 through 23, we'll dispense with half of these in one short piece, deal with group health insurance. Today, under current law, only group health insurance plans are required to comply with the managed care protections in AS 2107. These protections include requirements for both internal and external appeal processes for claim denials. The amendments to these sections would make the protections also applicable to individual health contracts. There are some other, what I think are non-substantive changes, which are designed to make terminology consistent with federal and state law. We replace health care with medical care, remove group to make these provisions also apply to individual contracts, and replace enrollee with a covered person. To get into what's probably the what I think is the controversial section of this bill, section 32 sets a minimum requirement for suitability standards, and I'd like to save discussion of that until the end, if that would be sure. Acceptable, because I have some thoughts on that. Section 33, and I obviously have grouped these so they're not particularly in order, nor do I intend to go through every section in this long bill. Again, we're putting provisions that are today applicable to group health insurance and making them applicable to individuals. Provider non-discrimination. Section 34 deals with prompt payment of health claim provisions. Section 36 is the NAIC standard non-forfeiture for individual deferred annuities. What we've done here is to address in 37 and 38 sections the annuity products with excessive surrender charges. And in effect, these changes limit surrender charges to about a 10% grading down to zero after 10 years and will no longer allow unrealistic maturity ages such as 115. That's not a particularly realistic date that people no longer are alive. Sections 41 adds the HIPAA mental health parity provisions that are currently in federal law. They are renewed there. Alaska law sunset, so we need to add those back. Section 42 to 44, these are on pages 33 to 36. We would repeal the Small Employer Health Reinsurance Association. Today, there are only two lives that are reinsured in that Small Employer Reinsurance Association. The administrative costs of running the association range from $10,000 to $12,000 a year. We have discussed this with industry, and it appears that this particular association has outlived its usefulness. and you know, industry is not at all opposed to us repealing this particular provision. Section 52 at the end of the bill provides for a transition to wind up the affairs of the association and how we would deal with that. Those are the basic concepts in the life and health changes. The balance of the bill makes changes in other provisions regarding the oversight of the entities we regulate and license. Section 25 is an adoption of the NAIC model actuarial opinion guidelines. Today, this is already done in the life and health industry. This particular section would adopt the guidelines for property casualty insurers. A domestic insurer would be additionally required to file with the Division of Insurance an actuarial opinion summary, which includes their estimate of a range of reasonable estimates of reserves and explains any adverse development. This gives the division an additional tool to more quickly identify an insurer that could be in a troubled financial condition. And again, we have worked with industry on this. We had some questions that have been resolved, and I have letters indicating that from those particular trade associations. Section 29 requires some changes in our managing general agent laws to streamline and be more consistent with national standards. Section 30 streamlines notification requirement for third-party administrators, employees. This was a request from an industry last year. We didn't get it in time to put in our bill to allow them to notify us of main contacts, not if they have 100 people who might deal with Alaska claims. They didn't want to have to change their list weekly if they had employee changes, so it modifies the requirement. Section 31 allows a division to publish a list of eligible surplus lines insurers on our website instead of by paper. It provides authority to reinstate a company under specific conditions, which would include payment of a late fee. Today, we don't have that flexibility. If a surplus lines insurer does not make the appropriate filings with us by the deadline, they have to start all over again. And that seems to have been a very cumbersome process. We would like to make that easier to work with so that it isn't a particular burden. We have, in 35, expanding authority for electronic communications. And generally, then, the last five sections deal with various repealers and effective dates. As I mentioned at the beginning, as we go through a bill of this technical nature and discussions, there have been some pieces that have resulted in questions. The confidentiality of actuarial opinions, the annuity surrender charges. The one that I think remains is the suitability standards. And I have had considerable discussion with industry over what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. We have seen in industry some examples of behavior that has probably been detrimental to consumers. And what I have proposed and will propose in this section is to modify the language that's currently in the suitability section to pertain only to long-term care products and to annuities. NAIC has adopted regulations in both of those areas. It's my understanding that the long-term care regulations have been adopted in 31 states. I would like to, and I have committed to using that same philosophy in adopting long-term care regulations. And the annuity regulations are also an NAIC model. We've seen examples of trade practices that are being violated in the selling of annuities to seniors. In earlier this month at the meeting in NAIC in Orlando, the model was changed to no longer only apply to those 65 and older, but removing that age requirement, so the suitability for annuities would apply regardless of the age of the purchaser, the consumer. So I would propose, because those are the two areas that there really already are standards nationally, that we limit suitability to those two areas. We have in the division had cases that we have taken legal action and been upheld under current statute. The suitability language gives us, I think, more consistency and will specifically authorize us to adopt regulations, and I would like very much to adopt the NEIC regulations. With that, I will stop, and I know this is a lot, it's a long bill, it's very technical. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Are there other questions? Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious on, you know, Section 32, the points of long-term care being the target, and if there's a differentiation between fixed and variable annuities and the...
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the long-term care products have increased in price. There were guarantees of pricing early on. Part of the suitability standards for long-term care deal with ability to pay. A long-term care product is only really effective if you buy it and you continue to pay for it until you need it. And what we found were as the products became more expensive, people were dropping coverage, which in effect, the money they put into the product was lost. So the suitability deals with need, other evaluation of other assets, the ability to have a plan to be able to pay long-term for that product so that it's available when someone is in need of long-term care. There is no differentiation between fixed and variable annuities. The Division of Insurance today regulates both. There is some dual regulation when you deal with securities and the securities aspect of the annuities, and so we do work with Division of Banking and Securities, and we have done some investigations and jointly where we're both looking at individuals who are selling products, but the suitability standards, I believe, would be the same.
Further questions?
Yes, and I was just wondering on the definition of reasonable, without reasonable grounds, how you plan on handling that within the regulations.
I think in the regulation, as I have read regulations and model regulations, there are, for example, the contract I looked at last week, the regulation had a form. The company set their own suitability standards. They had to have them. They had a consumer form that asked particular questions. It isn't we're going to tell you that the division wouldn't promulgate regulations that said you have to sell X to X and this to this person, but it's a more general guideline to be sure the product is appropriate for the financial needs and situation of the individual consumer.
Very good, very good, Madam Chairman. Just on this issue, I think there's been several cases, even some recently, some major insurance carriers being called to task on excessive replacement of some of these annuities and other policy issues in Florida and New York. So that it is an issue around the world, I mean around the country, I don't know, but around the world.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we participated in a multi-state settlement in exactly one of those cases against a national broker who had replaced particular number of annuities with a different annuity to the financial enhancement of the brokerage. And in that multi-state settlement, we got back all the surrender charges and some commitments going forward for those products to be monitored so that the Alaskan consumers who were part of that, I don't want to use the word churning, but that's kind of what it was, would not lose financially or by the quality of their contract. So that there are areas that need monitoring, and we are monitoring that and participating with other states in those types of situations, but they certainly do require attention.
Go ahead.
Even within the industry, on occasions, they find companies internally churning products. So I know it's a problem. If we could go to, Madam Chair, if we can go to page 27, line 22. That talks about proof of mailing notice. And there's an insertion in here now as the age of information is upon us. where they can do electronic receipts. I'm just kind of curious what kind of what's some of the background on this, because my concern is some of these type of documents are better in paper format for record keeping, and some people get confused even what documents they have, and they bring them in to have people within the field explain to them what it is. So if I can get a little bit of background on this.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think as you preface your comments, we are trying to update the ability of both insurers and the Division of Insurance to do electronic communication. And I think the reason that we've asked for this is that we have been asked by insurers who are doing increasing amounts of business electronically to allow them to provide information electronically if they have some documentation. And that certainly is key, as we've required proof of mailing for a number of years, that there is some proof of documentation that the document has been received. I strongly agree with you that consumers frequently do need explanation, but we're seeing a number of instances where people prefer to communicate electronically. Recently, it's probably not recently now, but a year or so ago, we adopted privacy regulations, and part of that was if the consumer asks for something electronically, they make requests electronically, then it is appropriate to respond to them electronically. But that is a consumer's election and a consumer's ability to document that they have received something.
Okay. I notice there's a qualifier in the sentence on 22, if the insurer can obtain an electronic confirmation. I guess I understand the direction of the industry going to make it more efficient and to drive their cost bases down, but just dealing with the public over the years, and there's a lot of instances where people get mail and they just don't understand what it is, and it's a challenge. Insurance is almost a foreign language to a lot of people. Now, are they going to be required then to do any kind of a backup mailing or anything, or they could just, if a consumer gives them an email address, they can just send it to their email, and then they get a response back that the email's been opened, and then
through the chair, Senator Stedman. No, we did. I don't think we planned on requiring a backup mailing. It would be somewhat redundant to do that. Generally, I would agree with you that insurance is very confusing to consumers. I'm not sure it's any less confusing to get it in the mail, frankly. Sometimes if they have a document and they can read it. So I'm not sure that's going to resolve the issue that consumers need to talk to an agent. It's one of the issues that we've seen over the years with internet sales of insurance, that consumers buy that because it may be a cheaper price, not really realizing that they are not buying it, comparing apples to apples. And frequently we get those kinds of complaints at the Division of Insurance. And I have to tell you that our typical response is you need an agent to help you work through the questions and the confusion that can result from an insurance product.
If I could, Madam Chair, maybe we could have her just explain a little bit what's going on in other states. I assume that this is a trend nationwide, and what kind of feedback she's gotten, and I'm sure we're not the only ones doing this. So.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, no, we are seeing this as a trend nationally and as a trend, I think, in areas way beyond just insurance, to have more electronic communication. As you indicate, it's in some ways it's more efficient, and it's easier to be able to do communication in that way. Many of the insurers today have websites where consumers can go on the website and change an auto. They can do a variety of tasks online at their convenience, not just when the insurance agent's office may be open. So I think we are seeing a trend nationally to do this, and we're seeing it allowed in many other jurisdictions.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to point out, obviously, if a customer is going to provide an email address, they have the facility and hopefully the ability to be involved in electronic communication. Certainly, if they don't provide an email address, it'd still be done by traditional hard copy. And I don't know that you would need an opt-in proviso. It seems as if it is an opt-in if you provide an email contact, as many people do when they communicate with us.
Anything else, sir?
No, I don't have anything else, unless you want to talk about the changes to the suitability language in any further detail.
Okay. Linda has presented us with an amendment, which I'm kind of mulling over. I'm having great difficulty with this. Oh, and by the way, I need to announce that my husband is an insurance agent and have no idea if he sells this kind of insurance mentioned in Section 32 or not.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Go ahead.
As reference on the, I have a question too, but as reference on the disclosure statements we file, I'm also licensed in life and health and so on and so forth and have a minority interest in an independent agency. But I do have another question when you have time, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
In the bill here, there's some talk about having an actuarial analysis done on the insurers and having them produce that to the your office so you could check suitability or viability, I guess I should say, of the insurer. And is the intent of this not only to judge the solvency of it, but to watch for predatory pricing in case one of the carriers gets into financial trouble somewhere else in the country and then starts moving prices down to try to increase their cash flow, and as we saw happen in portions of the workers' compensation several years ago? Is this a step in trying to put a check and balance in that system, or is that just one of the many reasons why you want to do this?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the guideline, the actuarial opinion guideline that is adopted in this particular section deals with reserving. Carriers are already required to provide, even on their financial statements, an actuarial opinion. They having an actuarial analysis of reserves is mandated today. This gives us the background, the work papers that will be available to the division of that actuarial analysis so that we do have, it is just, it's one additional tool. This would show potential financial impairment, which could be a result of predatory pricing, as you mentioned, that we have seen. Because reserves tend to be one of the things that can be, I'm trying not to use the word manipulated, but I don't know a better one, can be massaged, is that a better term? And we did see that in the major insolvency in 2003. The particular company in question, the workers' compensation carrier, was declared insolvent when the actuarial analysis doubled their reserves. So that was the effect of under-reserving. And we want to be sure we have the financial tools we need to watch for those types of under-reserving, which can then lead to misstatement of financial position.
Did that answer?
Yes, we all know the impact of that result years ago across the state. So, I think it's a good requirement.
Okay. The my problem with this, the Section 32 is, the in my you know, limited exposure to how the industry works. This is something they do that is done all the time, every day, for every product they sell. And because of the, and for a variety of reasons, for underwriting, for the suitability of the, I mean, the risk itself, the person, and this to me is unnecessary, and I'm not disposed to keep this in there at all. And I know the amendment we have needs an amendment. So we will basically set this aside. And if any of you have any more questions that you want to get cleared up or talk to Linda or Senator Bundy's office did the sponsoring or my office in drafting the amendment or CS language, we'll have that available. And yes, sir.
As we set it aside, just a closing comment when you're ready.
Okay, sure, yeah. And anyway, I find this language rather troublesome and would see it as a somewhat intrusive because it's what's done every day, all the time, with the issuance of all policies, unless I'm terribly mistaken. Senator Stepan?
I think you're correct when you look at most of the major carriers and the more reputable carriers. And on the security side, some of the more reputable broker-dealers. But there is, and I'm not saying that this language can't be reworked, but there is a problem within the industry on occasions where, for whatever reason, some of the suitability issues are kind of pushed aside for other, you know, corporate objectives. And I'm a little bit more familiar with on the security side than the insurance side, but on, you know, you're right in that there's a lot of documentation going on the last several years to justify recommendations for exchanges and replacements. And if those aren't documented in the file, then you know, you'll be notified by the supervising officers on that situation. So, are you looking to totally strike this and then come back with some modified language, or just strike it completely?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair.
Very clear on that, yes. I'm not sure. I'm just very concerned. I'm very concerned about the language we'll be mulling it over. Any other questions? Oh, Senator.
Just a comment. I had mentioned earlier that this was a bill by request, the reason I acceded to the request is that I felt that it would provide some greater consumer protection and makes Alaska licensing more consistent with national standards and it promotes some more efficient administrative procedures and industry oversight. So I suppose I say that because I didn't want to think I was blindly going into this, that I did feel there was some value in us doing it.
I understand. No, there's. I can see where the consolidation of the consistency of the language and all the changes to that, because you could 80% of it is just conforming language and making changes to definition. We'll set that aside and get back to that at a later time. Are there any other comments or any questions? If not, we are adjourned.